Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, we're talking about the season one finale, Rixy Business. Here's Aaron with the recap.
Beth and Jerry leave for the weekend to indulge in Jerry's Titanic fantasies and leave Grandpa Rick alone with the two kids. An intergalactic rager ensues, complicated by the fact that Morty accidentally sends the entire house to a strange alien world. Will Rick, Morty, and Summer get the house back to Earth in time to keep Beth and Jerry from discovering the chaos they've wrought? Will Jerry be able to avoid the rapacious grasp of a deluded theme park worker? Find out in the first half of the season-ending quasi-cliffhanger of Rick and Morty. Jim, season finale, Rixy Business. Yeah. What'd you think?
I think it's a great way to wind down a season. Just, you know, do what takes Rick's advice and just relax. Maybe snort a little Kalexian crystals. And I think all is good. All is good with season one. It's a good cap. I liked it.
Yeah, I know that they're, I guess historically, because I joined this show in season two. I wasn't one of the few, well, I guess not few, there's millions. Millions of them. The lucky millions that were in on it from day one. So I didn't get to indulge in this kind of like conversation, but I guess there's a lot of potential butthurt, or at least it was alluded to in some of the commentaries about the fact that you had last episode, which you know debuted the Council of Ricks and Evil Morty and like all this like awesome grandiose episodic, you know, cliffhanger, and then you go to essentially a house party that's also a cliffhanger, but it was designed that it could all I don't think there was any expectation that you would rejoin season two,
right?
Like they kind of made this into a cliffhanger out of nothing.
I would not really call this a cliffhanger. Like if you wanted to end the series here and it didn't get picked up again, I think this is a fine way to go out.
Right, right. Because, you know, it's reasonable to infer that Rick will, you know, fix things and everything's going to go back to normal. So that's, you know, I think that that's something that they kind of owned. You know, it's like, well, you know, and we praised how they've paced the episodes up to this point. And also, when you're just binging the season, you're just watching it on, you know, Hulu or Adult Swim's constant 24/7 marathon of Rick and Morty, this is a non-issue. And I think it's I think it's pretty fun. Burnt right through me like oxidizing laser eels in a garage.
Yeah, I mean it does feel a little bit like they're sort of unsure what Rick and Morty is going to be in the future. Whether, you know, I don't know if it had been renewed at this time or if it, you know, those negotiations were still up in the air, and it feels like they just didn't know how much continuity they wanted to have, and you really would put a stamp on the season by going out with close Rick counters of the Rick kind. Whereas I felt like this is almost a way to sort of hedge your bets and say, maybe we'll do a lot more of that stuff, but maybe we'll just have fun.
Yeah. Well, we've seen other shows that like sometimes pivot. Like a famous example is this series Justified, which I love.
Yeah, yeah.
Season one is very much X-Files, you know, mobster of the week, railing, you know, going and dispensing justice to those. And then in season two, they pivoted to more of, you know, stuff that spans entire seasons and, you know, it's a consistent storylines. Episodic is what I'm trying to get at. So, yeah, that might be a good way to kind of like, you know, lead off on a base but still keep your foot on it, you know.
Right, right.
Like, hey, yeah, there's going to be some fun questions raised, but it's not every episode is going to hinge on what's latest with Evil Morty and Evil Rick and the Council of Ricks. And honestly, thank God, because that, you know, I don't know how much strain you want to put on those particular plot points. They're really fun, and they're fun because they are open-ended. They ask a lot of questions, and, you know, when you start answering those questions in any mystery box situation, that's when this show starts closing in on itself. And
right.
I continue to enjoy watching Rick and Morty expand.
And for a show that seems like it is fraught with Herculean efforts of writing.
Yeah.
Just trying to get this show created seemed like a hard thing to do. If you also add that sort of serialization to it where everything has to reconnect in on itself. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine how much Dan would obsess about that?
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you could never just relax and have fun like this episode does, they drive right. themselves insane.
Yeah, and it would also, it seems like it would be unsatisfying for Justin, too, who likes to be able to color outside the lines.
Oh, yeah.
And so having a healthy balance of both is probably going to be a long-term benefit to Rick and Morty fans everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, this is a house party episode with a B-plot of domestic quasi-domestic tranquility out of Rick and, or I'm sorry, Beth and Jerry.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah. So what do you want to talk about first? I feel like you're raring to talk about Beth and Jerry.
Yeah, because I kind of think Beth is shitty in this episode.
I mean, like, she's got a reason. She's got this whole season, she's had one foot out the door of this relationship. But yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not going to argue too much that, you know, Beth is even close to the worst person on the show. But in this episode, like, they go on this Titanic-themed getaway that Jerry is clearly jazzed about. He is absolutely looking forward to this.
This is jam.
And they get there, and Beth just fucks off. And I don't even understand at this point. Like, it's so shitty for Beth not to at least, if she's going to go on this trip with him, not to at least try to enjoy it. Instead, she gets there and she shits all over it. These storylines are sort of parallel in that, in which, you know, Morty and Beth are sort of the characters who are not on board with any of this shit. Morty's the party pooper, and Beth is also a party pooper.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I just felt like it was kind of shitty, and I didn't. I guess when Beth says, hey, do you see me putting in work here? This is not a shining example of that.
Yeah, this is her blazing on the job. It does seem like an ethical person, because, you know, ethical people can break up and they can, you know, leave relationships. Like, an ethical decision would be, you know what, the kids are what they are. They're getting older. I don't love Jerry. Jerry's a mess. I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna make this a clean break. So you can either do that, or you can, like, say, like, you know what, Jerry, this is your deal. Why don't you find one of your friends online? I'm sure you've got a few that are into Titanic and do that. Or not go, or go and, you know, go be all in, because it is really shitty, to do that to a person. I actually thought I was kind of pulling for Jerry, mm-hmm. because Jerry's the type of person that, you know, he goes on this thing, his wife kind of shits on it the whole time, and he finds a friend and, you know, is not bitter and resentful by the fact that, you know, Beth doesn't want to be in on this. He's just happy that he found someone that is. And then, you know, poor Jerry, he winds up into a fucking insane situation.
He sure
does.
Where
he almost gets himself raped at gunpoint.
And you get the impression that it's not the first time this has happened. Like,
oh, I mean,
there's the story about the Slavic man, which clearly is very close to home.
What does a rapist look like, Jim?
and it harkens back. A lot of these jokes, they sort of use time and again in this show, because it harkens back to Summer in Anatomy Park when Summer's boyfriend mm-hmm. is describing...
Sure.
You know, some weird thing that happened in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar vibes.
No, I mean, yeah, it's like, it's one of the reasons, honestly, I love this show, because it's like a show that deals with the reality that we are told statistically. Like, you know, it's always like, oh, 1 out of 4 women are going to be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And I think the statistic for boys is like 1 out of 7.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is, we got a lot of people that are walking around here with trauma. And, you know, it kind of changes how I feel about Jerry, that he might be like, maybe he's so indecisive and kind of go with the flow, because that's some kind of survival mechanism he's picked up. Still doesn't, I mean, you know, damaged and traumatized people are not the easiest ones to deal with, which is why we should damage and traumatize people and help them to get help when they are, so they can rejoin society as healthy adults. But having said all that, typically in these episodes, I've been sympathetic towards Beth and kind of antagonistic towards Jerry, and this did flip the dynamic, which is good, because, like, speaking of the show's dynamic, it would probably be unhealthy for Jerry to just completely devolve into everyone's whipping boy, have no redeeming moments,
sure.
Et cetera.
Yeah, definitely. And you see Jerry redeeming himself in certain moments where he saves Beth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of like a reversal of that as well. They're mm-hmm. switching up that dynamic where Beth comes in and saves Jerry.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of role reversal here, and it's, I guess, interesting to watch.
I talked to a therapist, and he said, typically the worst kind of split and division of responsibility for why a relationship is shitty is like 45-55. like it's almost always evenly split. Everyone's bringing, and I mean, I know that's not for, you know, I'm absent physical abuse, emotional abuse. Like if you're just kind of in a bad, shitty marriage, usually both people are roughly equally to blame because, you know, there's ways you can de-escalate. There's ways that you can, you know, take a step back and, you know, act more like adults. It's, you know, people, we don't teach that kind of thing. So, I like the fact that they're not allowing us to just, you know, root for Beth and shit on Jerry, that they add a little things of like, okay, well, you know, maybe if she had tried harder, maybe if, you know, Jerry'd be more present in real life the way he is in this fantasy thing, like there's always lessons you can take from it.
And then this episode has, or this half the episode has maybe my favorite moment, which is just seeing Jerry's drawing of this woman.
I haven't captured your sexy eyes. Did you know that down in Pigeon Forge this exists? Like
I
don't know if it actually rams a foam rubber iceberg, but there is a full-size Titanic that you can walk and tour, and I do believe it's in water, and I think there is an iceberg right ahead. And
wow, I need to check that out.
I don't know if they knew that, but yeah, like Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg and all these, like, you know, kind of establishments in the mountains. They got some weird shit, man.
They do.
They got some weird shit. Weird, kitschy shit.
Dolly Parton has a theme park.
She has several.
It's a weird place.
She has, there's Redneck Dinner Theater.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton has a horse riding. Like, it's like medieval times, only yeehaw.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. So there you go. All you can drink, iced tea.
How about the other half of this one? The big rager, the interdimensional rager.
I mean, there's a lot of elements I found really fun. It's interesting to see, like, the type of people that Rick would to invite to a party, you know, the Squanchy character, which is like I don't know, a take on all those like little animal sidekicks that He-Man and the Thundercats would have, where every verb is their essential name. And it's great. It's like one of those guys, only maybe he got into meth after He-Man was canceled and he likes his autoerotic asphyxiation, but he's a party animal. So what are you going to do, not call Squanchy?
Nah, you got to call Squanchy.
You're not going to be able to get your Squanch on if you don't have Squanchy. I love, like, Slow Mobius. I loved Birdman because I grew up watching a lot of Buck Rogers. And this bird person is literally the hawk from Buck Rogers. And that's a lot of fun. And how, when Rick and him have that conversation about, like, when's the last time you got your beak wet? And he's like, it's been a challenging mating season for Birdman. Mm-hmm. I just love that delivery. I love the sci-fi mashup with just, like, you know, 30-something kind of relational troubles. It's great. It's great.
It is, yeah. And one of my favorite moments from this half is when Rick coerces Morty and the undesirables, I guess, of the party to leave and go find these crystals.
Uh-huh.
And it's revealed that Morty has just been bamboozled into getting Rick his drugs.
Right.
That's so good.
There's a lot of background details, like when the house gets taken to another dimension, the TP that, you know, the toilet paper that had been TP'd all over the house, like, stays, so it all kind of, like, goes to the ground like streamers. There's also when Morty throws the drugs outside, one of the giant aliens grabs it, and then you can see it cavorting in a drug-fueled craze in the background for the next several scenes. I love it. I love it. I also really liked, the whole, I mean, this has happened a couple times this season already where, you know, Rick has you thinking that he's doing something altruistic, like, Abe Rudolph Linkler has his heroic death to get the party back to Earth. And it turns out, it's just Rick could have taken us back at any time. He just wanted the Kalax.
So Abe Rudolph Linkler is interesting. I think it's a funny concept for a character.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading around on the wiki and I found out that Abe Rudolph Linkler is not an original Rick and Morty creation.
Seriously?
It was actually conceived of in Cheers. season 2, episode 17 in 1983.
The classic Cheers did it. You can't do anything because right. Cheers did it all.
The high Simpsons concepts, and Cheers, forget it.
Sci-fi rigmarole's not safe from Cheers. They'll jack your shit.
I just thought that was crazy, though, that this exact concept was, you know, written into a script. And I don't know if that bled over, like,
it's gotta
they
be
had
some...
seen it when they were kids. And
yeah, I wonder.
Yeah.
Because, like, I thought, and the commentaries, if we can, you know, peer through BM77 a little early, made it pretty clear that it was a send-up of, I forget what the... There's a classic G.I. Joe plot where Cobra was, as an organization, was stealing the DNA from various, like, they were going to Napoleon's grave and Genghis Khan, like, up in the Himalayas, and they're stealing all this genetic material from these dead military commanders and combining it to make a perfect supreme human being. I think it's called Serpento or something like that. So I just assumed it was one of those things, like you're trying to genetically engineer an ideal political ruler. So you, of course you just take some, and that's the other thing is, like, that's Rick's approach. Like, you just literally take,
yeah,
I guess, one of the American presidents that everyone feels pretty good about, if you know, and then you take one of the history's greatest monsters and it's plus and minus
he tried that out. In Rick Potion number 9 too,
right,
with the Cronenbergs, and it didn't fucking work.
Well, you know, science is more of an art than a science. A lot of people don't appreciate that, Jim.
That's why they call it science.
That's right. There's also further, you know, we've talked about a lot about Wubba Lubba Dub Dub.
We sure have.
And I love the recontextualization here, that this is actually some kind of bird person curse that says, I am in great pain, help me. And that also says something interesting about Morty, that you're watching him, like, the punishment for Rick destroying the house would be he never is allowed to go on Rick's adventures anymore. And Morty is all about preventing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, when he is caught, like, at first you think, well, maybe it's subconscious. He's just, you know, because that happens a lot. People get in self-destructive patterns, and if they get a chance to escape it, they resume the self-destructive patterns because, you know, we're creatures of habit, and it feels sometimes, you know, routine is comfortable even when it's what's hideous.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Bird Person kind of calls him on it and says, this is what you're doing, he doubles down and he wakes up Rick and he saves the day so we can keep doing the adventures. It tells us that, you know, and all us trying to, like, place bets about whether Rick loves his grandkids and his child, there's also kind of like, how does Morty feel about his grandpa? And what's the appeal there?
I don't know. Morty is interesting. I constantly question whether Morty is aware enough to even understand what, you know, Rick's manipulation means.
And he's 14, so probably not. Like,
right, and they say he's, you know, developmentally challenged a little bit. So, like, how much of the world around him does Morty understand? I can't imagine, like, even when it's pointed out to him, that Morty fully understands what Bird Person is talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also wonder if, like, he's so insecure that, like, he is able to impress Jessica for, like, a briefest instant with some kind of crazy thing that his grandpa's invented.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he's so insecure that he thinks that he has nothing to offer to the world, but when he does these things with Rick, you know, it's special, and he does things that no one else is able to do, and, like, that bit of reflected glory makes him feel special, and he can see, it's like, oh, maybe not now, but a year or two of adventure with the grandpa, you know, maybe I get a cool facial scar and an eye patch and Jessica will love me because I'll have a lightsaber or some shit.
Right, yeah.
I mean,
could be as simple as that.
I'm pretty sure I had that exact fantasy as a 14-year-old. I didn't have a crazy Grandpa Rick to possibly fulfill it, but, like, you know,
right.
If I had an adamantium skeleton and claws, then girls would like me.
And there's also stuff in this episode that, you know, shows the other side of that coin. Rick, Summer, and Morty enjoying each other's company for, like, 6 months in frozen time world. What does that say about Jerry and Beth's effect on the family, I guess?
I mean, yeah, you kind of combine this with the Rick Potion number 9 where, like, Beth, Jerry, and Summer are happy.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder, and now it's like, well, maybe it's Rick that's corrupting influence, but you get the parents out of the house, and now it's like almost there's this rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock situation where, like, they all make each other miserable, but if you can split any triumvirate from that party, then they can make a go of it. It'd be an interesting thesis to see if throughout the rest of Rick and Morty, if you ever see some of these other pairings, like, you know, if can Rick, Jerry, and Morty be happy?
Oh, boy. I mean, we sort of saw that in the simulation one.
Right, a little bit. And, I mean, but even then, Jerry's kind of off doing his own thing. I think that's probably, like, I think Rick, Beth, and Summer, that sounds like a party on wheels. Mm-hmm. You know, it's getting Morty and Jerry together because they both kind of have that kind of Eeyore sad sack personality. and there's nothing to really balance them out. So, that would be a challenging pair. That'd be a challenging pairing.
I always feel like it's a challenge when Rick and Jerry are in a group because they both clearly hate each other.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just a big feedback loop that I don't know how you get out of that.
Yeah. Whereas that, I think that Rick doesn't really hate anybody else in the Smith family.
No, I don't think so.
He might have trouble. They might annoy the shit out of him and be a stinging fissure in his ass, but yeah, he doesn't hate him. What do you think of the alien gangbang stinger? This is one of the bigger like what the fuck ones for me.
Sure, yeah. But I like it.
Like, Linkler heroically survives and vows vengeance, but then he's just going to be passed eternally from one alien orifice to the other.
Until the crystals wear off or they get tired or...
Were they all? I didn't even notice. Were they their eyes all blue tinted?
You know, I didn't notice either.
That would be hilarious if it was also drug fueled.
It would, yeah.
Like Wolf of Wall Street, intergalactic party.
If you got a whole planet full of crystals, you know.
I mean, yeah, one of those aliens had to stuff it someplace dissolvable
during an orgy.
Oh,
hell
sure.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Hit me with the clock beam.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined, just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. All right, Jim, are you ready to go plot to the future?
I am.
Where we open up the portal to Dimension BM77 to access behind-the-scenes details, trivia, and spoilers for future episodes. This actually has quite a bit of important continuity for later episodes. It introduces the character of Tammy, which is the love of Birdman, who eventually gets involved in some intergalactic wedding where it's revealed that she's actually a Federation mole that is there to collect all of Rick's criminal friends. You know, Squanchy's part of that episode, too. He can turn into a vicious monster. I believe at the end of this final third season, Birdman has been rebuilt by Tammy into, or Bird Person, rather, has been rebuilt into Tammy as like, what was it? Mecha Birdman or something like that?
It's been too long. I remember.
She was pissed that it wasn't Phoenix or something, but this is like Rick's buddies. These are Rick's like old school diehard friends. They are all and are implied to be wanted intergalactic criminals in their own right. But there's also kind of hint that, especially with Bird Person, there's some kind of nobility there. Or there's some kind of like maybe a freedom fighting aspect to the stuff. But like that, this is kind of the episode that starts off all of that particular eck those particular plots. I don't know why I said eck. What the hell got cross-referenced in my memory banks?
I mean, that's
banks.
The Gazorpazorpian word for
shit. Yes. Yeah. It's actually shot. We need to. Is there anything above MA for podcast? Because I think Ek is the N-word crossed with the C-word.
Raised by all the bad words for Jews.
That is one of the more colorful descriptions of like an unspeakably bad.
Hell yeah, that's such a great description. At least you didn't say glip-glops.
That's half the galaxy. That's a hate crime. I thought it was interesting when Dan and the director and Justin were talking about you know, like this Titanic thing. And they mentioned that, like, they kind of see send-ups of real-life pop culture-type events as off-limits. Not because they're above it or anything, but in their mind, like, South Park does that kind of, like, immediate reaction to something weird in a popular culture better than anyone, and you don't even want to try to go up. How do you feel about that?
But I just don't understand how it's quite different from doing something that's 20 years old. Like, you're just late to the party, but you're still doing it.
Yeah, I wonder if it's more. Yeah, that's what I. It's like, because clearly it's not a hard and fast rule because they do it, you know?
They do it like, all the time.
Maybe it's useful as an axiom to, like, in the writer's room, like, are we really going to try to out South Park, which.
Yeah.
If that's a gauntlet that could be picked up in the writer's room and like, fuck yeah, we're going to out South Park, but it's also a warning.
Yeah, it's hilarious to me because Dan seems to experience such shame in regard to like spoofing pop culture references and in regard to like developing whole plot lines that are based on these other things. And yet it seems like everything he does that. Like he's sort of got this dichotomy where he both dislikes that doing that and also does it in all of his work.
Yeah.
To some degree.
I think that's interesting too. And I kind of can sympathize with him because I've always devalued the things I'm both really good at and are easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like, well, that's stupid. Obviously anyone could do it because I'm a fucking moron and I can shit these out with regularity instead of being like, oh, that's actually a unique talent that delights a lot of people. It shouldn't be, but I don't know. Cause some of that, it's not a healthy way to live, I wouldn't say, but it also tends to produce superior content because you're just constantly filtering anything that's not like if any idea makes it through that like gauntlet of shame, it's probably a really fucking solid idea.
And also like having people around you who clearly love it, right? Everybody else involved in this project was like, no, hell yeah, we love the Titanic thing. Like,
yeah, it's like, well, if I respect all these people and they think it's a good idea, then. But yeah, it's I can see how like it's probably a little bit of shame of like, you know, if it's something I'm good at and it comes to me easy, it must be low quality. And also just like, oh, man, if you just lean into that and do it over and over and over again, like at what point do you become a hack? Like, I mean, that's the thing. That's the hell that every creative is in, right? It's like every musician is just like they're one album away from being hack sellouts. And it's like we're just still making the music that we like, but now that is not popular. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's almost like if you don't challenge yourself to do something different or something better, then yeah, you will fall into that trap.
I mean, look at look at Hollywood, look at the entertainment culture. Like, clearly there's nothing that's necessarily pushing for the best in quality. Like, it's all their people are all too happy with shitting out inferior content and making money or not. So,
and this definitely doesn't feel inferior. Like, even when they're doing these cultural references as B plots for their episode, it feels like they put a lot of effort into, you know, exactly how they're going to play out, how they're going to, you know, twist it up to make it not just a Titanic with Beth and Jerry.
Because it could have been easily like, you know, Jerry relives all of the Titanic and it's just funny to see that happen. It's like, it turns into like a really bad 12:45 a.m. Saturday Night Live skit. It's like, you know, barely made the dress rehearsal cut. I thought it was also interesting their discussion about the Rick dance, because this is another one where apparently people did not get that this is deeply ironic take on all the stupid like this, because it, you know, they mentioned the commentaries, Family Matters, Steve Urkel, Bartman had the Bart dance. Like, it's almost like, hey, what lazy thing can we do to cash in on some kind of peak popularity? You got the catchphrases, you got the stupid t-shirts, you got the dance. But it's like, are you familiar with Poe's Law?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially, you know, when you lampoon something hard enough, it sort of wraps back around and becomes the thing that you are trying to lampoon.
Yeah, or it's indistinguishable.
Like, indistinguishable,
like,
yeah.
Like a parody of, like, for example, fascism, if it's done really well, can also be unironically enjoyed by fascists. It's very hard to do.
Right.
I just watched like an hour-long video talking about the producers and like how, like, it's amazing how well that works, because it cited a lot of examples of like fascism and popular culture, like American History X. American History X is not a sympathetic portrayal of white nationalists, but white nationalists fucking love American History X. Same thing with like, what's the Tyler Durden?
Fight Club.
Fight Club, right? Like, that's like, if a reasonable person without any kind of preconcepts watch that film, it's like that worldview is being put on trial, yet there's tons of edgy dudes that unironically think it's the greatest thing. So,
right.
You know, if you do a send up of the stupid dance crazes and you do it well enough, then people are not going to be able to tell that you're being ironic. And
that's clearly happened. I mean, fans of the show go around saying "wubba lubba dub dub" to everything. And
I don't
think
thank God the Rick dance didn't, you know, they didn't make.
Because
that's the thing. If they'd made like a music video released on an MTV, then you fell down the Poe's Law Valley and rolled up the other side of it. So.
Yeah, they did that with Perfect Strangers. I don't know if you've seen Balky rapping.
It's fucking terrible. I know there was a ditty in the Bibby Bobcat episode, but...
No, this goes to an entirely different level.
Oh, God. I wonder if there is like some musician that offended an ABC executive back in the 80s, and he's chained to some desk, doomed to write all of the arrangements and lyrics for these shitty things for their, you know, Thank God It's Friday lineup. One other note is, and I think they're pretty faithful to this from this point forward, the driveway is going to be permanently fucked up. Like, there will always be that crack where the house got dislocated in time and space.
Yeah, that's crazy, because they fixed everything else so thoroughly, but they couldn't get this crack out of the driveway.
I mean, driveway's cracked, but yeah, I do like that little bit of, you know, permanent continuity, and I wonder if they'll ever be, like, you know, Jerry fixes it. Like, I don't know how this driveway got cracked, but I'm gonna see to it.
Maybe we could go into the crack. Maybe there could be like a whole world underneath the house that, like, the testicle monsters came back and they've been just sort of under there doing their thing.
Sure. If you pass,
sounds like
crack.
What a hack writer would write.
Yeah, right.
In 20 seconds. In
20 seconds of thought of it. Yeah. let's just start. Just send it to animation.
Yeah.
Now that you said it, it is like Rick could fix this with some kind of like.
Oh yeah.
Concrete demeculizer gun.
Right.
So. I mean, you know, they had 6 months to fuck around. Just bad craftsmanship, as Rick would say.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns,
and myself, Ben Aaron, from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media at Bald Move. See you next time.